No panic here. We'll stay for a bit and have Q&A. So Bill O'Farrell has the mic and the first question.
Rick, you were talking about the film from 1915, and you cited it as being something from educational screen. And I was sitting there thinking, like, but they didn't start till 1922. And I realized you were talking about the Crow's Papers. And I just thought I'd make a point of saying that Charles Tupperman, who's at the University of Chicago, did a full set of photocopies of it from one end to the other of the Crow's Papers. And we've got a master of those. It's a anecdotal, to a certain extent, history of the educational film and industrial films and, you know, the markets growing in Chicago and, you know, all over the country. And it's unbelievably fascinating. And when Sean was working on The Eye Beholds, we had another intern at Northeast Historic who came across a Crow's reference to the Bureau of Commercial Economics. And like we were all just like beyond, like, you know, like getting very excited about the depth of information. That master is at NHF. We haven't really got any kind of a plan about what to do with those photocopies, but if anybody is interested in getting a set of those copies, we're talking, I think, maybe 200 pages, and they're like three columns, and it's just dense, and it goes from like 1900 to 1940, history of those films. We could, you know, see how many people are interested and then try and figure out if there's a way of making copies of them and getting them out there.
I was in that regard. Richard Kozarski keeps telling me that he's actually going to publish those as a book. And I wrote him a couple weeks ago, but I've not heard the status of that. I relied really heavily on Crow's for the first draft of the book. And then my publisher, my editor, looked at a lot of the facts and figures. And it turns out that Crow's, it really is a memoir because it actually gets a lot of the facts wrong. So it's incredibly useful for understanding relationships between people and institutions, the flavor of things. But he needs to be fact checked. But it's totally great read.
Bernard Timberg and I faced a similar problem, maybe not as great in scale, in writing a book about the history of the television talk show. And it was an interpretive history, and my partner Bob Erler is a reference librarian, and he created a guide. But even just for the television talk show, leave radio aside, as you got to define, you know, the cooking shows and the book show, you know, how do you make sense of this? And a point of reference here, and you could, any of you could comment on this, could be discourse theory. I used, because I studied under James Kinavey's theory of discourse. And he starts talking about referential discourse. And Bob and I worked on it, and we boiled down to certain aims, and we gave an introduction to our guide, which I think is pretty good. It started to create categories using the history of rhetoric to date. Is that something that you've considered or would be useful?
I'm looking around me because my education is quite deficient in that area. I wonder if any of the others here would have thoughts about that.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, I guess we could put that perhaps together with Greg Waller's question about how do we use this guide to bring the films into the classroom, and I guess one of the wonderful things about the guide is that there are so many opportunities for cross-disciplinary connections, and perhaps those who use discourse theory might find these films in particular of value to show, you know, sort of historically how discourse, how art of persuasion, which is what I take you to mean by discourse theory. Oh, no.
Explain a little more. What we boiled down to for... By discourse theory, it's information, it's persuasion, it's self-expression, diaries. Modern rhetoric is not, you know, the speech or the persuasive alone. it's, in Kinavey's terms, it's very broad. For instance, for the talk show, we narrowed down to basically three discourse traditions that predominate: news, coming out of various forms of news discourse, entertainment, and of course, what interestingly happens is they start to blend till we have Jon Stewart and Bill Maher. I mean, if you follow this pattern. The third was the socially situated encounter, and that was mimicking everything from, you know, a book club to house building to, you know, instructional to people's court. You know, it simulated some kind of real world, including the game shows, which simulate games in front of cameras. And that covered a lot of stuff. It, you know, it sounds simple, but it took us a long time to realize, yeah, you can cover the waterfront with that kind of classification. But that, as I said, they come out of broader discourse.
Well, that sounds like the second generation. This is just the field guide. What we're trying to do is put out some general characteristics that will help people identify these films, because they're all over the place, and it's really hard for archivists and for scholars just to put their hands on them and figure out what qualities they have and how to identify them. That's one of the great things Rick has added to the note field, is information about whether it was released in Technicolor, what gauge it was in, because this will help people find them and see if they have a complete copy and if they should try to preserve it. Because after all, that has to be one of our justifications for doing this project as a National Film Preservation Foundation, to look ahead to the preservation process. Now, that should be the second generation publications coming from this, I hope.
I think you'll find that the coffee tasting film is a kind of metaphor for the excitement and the frustration of working with this material when you see the guide. We resisted creating any sort of grid or generic category for the films, except for the descriptive lines that would help someone in the field, because it's a little like the coffee tasters. There are no rules. There are no absolutes. Everything is contingent. And when you start to read these descriptions and process the material, you'll see that it's a completely wide open field. It's very different from the kind of classical Hollywood cinema or art cinema or documentary production or television production that we're used to. And you see all kinds of force fields moving through it. You see lineages that go back to cinematography instruction courses. You see lineages that go back to anthropology films. You see tropes, as Rick was pointing out, that continue over and over and over. And I find it very exciting, because you can bring so many critical grids to the field. And I think that discourse theory is something that would be very compelling to use. Another way to look at it is to take props, categories of narratives, and you can reduce these various films down to certain basic narratives and see how the different films plug into it. I think that if there are any Jungian theorists out there, you could have a field day with this corpus of work. It's really quite extraordinary.
Just very quickly, at FCMS, Charles Ackland and Anna McCarthy were talking about typologies of films based on formal considerations, as you mentioned, and I think that's really, really productive and exciting, because for years the conventional wisdom or the prevailing wisdom has been that these films are transparent, that they're artless except for, you know, the city and the plow that broke the plains, and we need to understand a lot more about how these films work and function, and that largely hasn't been done.
Thanks. That's a good segue to my question. It's Charles Ackland here. Listen, this is, the guide is fantastic, and I really appreciate that it was circulated to us beforehand. That was, I think, quite useful. So I'm probably going to ask a question that you don't want to hear at this point, which is, are there plans for a second edition? In other words, are there plans for this to become a living, maybe not a lifetime's work, but something that grows and develops? And I say that because I'm sure as you encounter doing this work, it becomes a highly, highly selective process. And, yeah, I mean, who would have thought that we would say something like this? But there's a kind of informal canonization that goes on. In other words, certain films get referred to more frequently than others, and the concerns about the historiographic impact of that would be fairly substantial. So I'm curious what you have.
Well, I'm so pleased you're looking ahead to the future.
Absolutely.
You know, at a nonprofit, small nonprofit like the NFPF, we look ahead to just getting the operating budget for the next year. So doing the next edition is really quite an exciting opportunity. But actually, we're trying just to get this edition out. And, you know, look, you should, as scholars and as archivists, people need to think of other tools you have to build on the horizon. And I've often wondered, just sitting back as a nonprofit administrator, why scholars and archivists haven't banded together to start thinking about catalogs for nonfiction films. Why is there just an AFI catalog? Why isn't there a catalog for the other types of films that have been made in America? Now, these are good questions that could be answered by communities working together to do this kind of thing. If scholars and archivists were to band together, maybe you could go to big funders and get the kinds of dollars that are required to do that kind of cataloging. And, you know, it's not impossible. It's just a question of mobilizing to do it. Sounds like an industrial film, doesn't it?
I say we bring archivists and scholars together and put on a big symposium and have a big discussion about how we would do this. And
that won't work.
A follow-up question, though, I had, which is actually the canonization question, occurred to me, and I think the good one is, how do we follow up? We had talked about in the early stages of the grant development about a wiki kind of model where people could upload unverified information, which could then, you know, grow as it got vetted. That's certainly true. But something for anyone else, of course, it's also limited as a national project, and the Netherlands Film Museum brought us materials to see if we could identify seemingly American material that might be held in other archives. Anyone have thoughts about how to deal with this problem? Do we just leave each nation to write its own history, or do we deal with the kind of international, you know, border crossing, the fact that many American films are abroad and vice versa, since it's obviously not just an American phenomenon, even though it's primarily perhaps one in terms of production numbers?
I'd add to that cluster of questions. There's a whole group of films that we've not really done justice to, which is films made in the United States about operations abroad, films made for and about international organizations. It's really big. I think, you know, let's get this book out and then think about a follow-up structure, because the idea is, again, it's very much a first attempt to isolate a bunch of films for further research, for preservation, for attention. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of writing constitutions till we have a nation yet, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it'd be very nice if we do like a wiki where people contribute research. I think it's going to be a very slow flow of information unless it's actually orchestrated and paid for. But that's one possible follow-up. And then, of course, there's other areas of film to do more books on. I'd love to see a Canadian book.
Question about canonization. That's definitely the case. I mean, one of the things that strikes me, though, is that that always is already going on by default. I mean, it's by what's available, and it's been, in fact, the ephemeral film Laserdisc canonized what I used in film history classes in the 1980s. So to some extent, that process is already in place by what's out there, by what's on the Treasures of American Film Archives. In fact, I would suggest it is likely what's going to get taught about a number of these different non-theatrical or non-Hollywood genres. So any way you can begin to expand that with full knowledge that any list is arbitrary seems to me worthwhile and useful.
Well, I would add to that the one thing we have going for us with this project is that in the process of canonizing these films, they won't be able to be taken out of context so readily, so easily. So I think that if we do find that we start to teach the same films, use the same films as classroom examples again and again, it will be much easier for us to provide a broader, a richer picture of the exhibition reception context for these films. And that, I think, is something that, this in terms of canonizing certain films, I think the guide sort of resists that.
Not at this point.
or whatever, I would think a really good supplement to make this a tool in the teaching world would be a DVD of samples or of some of these films that you're categorizing.
One of the wonderful things about the body of material that's in the book is that a great deal of them, I mean, really, I haven't done a check, but overwhelmingly they're in the public domain, so that leaves a great deal of room to do precisely that. Of course, we don't know that some of the films exist. So.
Yeah. I was going to suggest that this selection you showed today, if that were on... in some medium right now, a DVD, you would stimulate your field 1,000 times, you know, to first just make them easily available to some of us who teach nonfiction cinema or teach this cinema exactly. I don't know where to find these things, and I'm very excited to see them. So that I would say that's got to be on the playlist somehow. Two is a just crude question. Are any of these films of any... contain any useful information? Three, I would not put this material out into the public arena or space without somebody writing about them politically, which Don suggested there might be a politics of this cinema, but to put them out there as just, you know, interesting cinema history and to not have somebody writing about them is devastating. In some way, I am a victim of these films. You know, for me, art was what Johnson Wax said it was in 1952. I just happened to be old enough. All the information that came into my classrooms came by way of sponsors like these. It took years to get out of there, you know, to not be the housewife who's ecstatic over her red phone. So somebody has to be writing about these materials with a, you know, critical edge, critical culture. And thank you for bringing them out.
I think that the people who are probably going to be answering that are in the room, many of them. And they're probably not our generation, Jill, because we are so imbound with nostalgia. And and there is this notion that... that you are seeing your life history spool out in these films sometime. This is a confession that nobody knows. I don't think even my wife knows it, but I was the AV guy. So my job was to thread up the Bellenhall projector and show these films at the assembly.
That was obviously a career path. For
Well, I remember one time in particular that we had the segregated assembly, which was very rare and only happened once a year. So all the boys were in the boys' gym, and all the girls were in the girls' gym. And I never knew what the girls watched at their assembly, but the boys watched Hemo the Magnificent.
It's in the book. Yeah.
But, of course, now I realize that the girls were watching Molly Grows Up. Or
Tinkerbell explaining this.
That would be the story of menstruation, the Disney. and already at that age, we had gender difference being defined cinematically. And there are so many things I would think, you know, without going into some sort of a deep psychoanalysis, that still inform people who were explicit. It's sort of like the Ludovico syndrome in Clockwork Orange.
And that reminds me of something which I've inexplicably forgotten, which is that about a third of the films that are listed in the book are available in some form or another online, and the book will give a web reference. So access is kind of built in.
And the other access story is that there's also the repositories where the things are found, and I think you will find that many of the repositories that do hold these films will work very closely with you within the bounds of any copyright issues. But I know if you contacted the Archive Center, you know, we could make you dirty dubs of just about anything for classroom use. So I think a lot of the archives are very accommodating.
I guess a question primarily for Don, but maybe for Jenny as well. Question about this issue of how these films can be read profitably using existing resources of sort of cinema history. Because, Don, I think what you did with your film is in a lot of ways indebted, you know, very deeply indebted to conventional history. And yet you say you think there are a lot of things that haven't been thought about yet. And so I'm curious about that and just about how to negotiate this issue about trying to both recognize but not sort of ghettoize this kind of filmmaking and also insisting maybe on some level that these films, you know, informed or, you know, were influenced by, but then also sort of reflected back into mainstream commercial entertainment in some way.
It's a fair question, and I guess my short answer would be it's hard to think of something that hasn't been thought of before, especially when you haven't had enough sleep. But the one of the reasons I think that my film worked so well is because it's built into the structure of that film, cinematography and narrative forms and everything that are derivative from Hollywood models. And so it was easy for me to use the, you know, Hollywood analysis technique to kind of open up that film. What do you do with the Madison newsreel? And there I would have to challenge you, Oliver, and people like you to come up with some new tools for the job. Well, Bordwell and Thompson isn't going to get you very far.
Thank you for saying that.
This is a great opportunity to bring other disciplines into the use of film, too, like the Ulmer film we saw the other night. It's too bad we didn't have a historian of public health here to talk about really how TV was being treated, about the network of sanitariums across the country, and about really the difficulty in bringing the public health menace to the in front of the eyes of everyday working people. And the films were an important way to connect. So I think what we might have here in this visual history is a way of a sort of a history of communicating with people about problems and things that were important in many different disciplines. So it could be a very clever way to get your colleagues into using film in their classrooms too.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that one thing that I've been impressed with in going through the drafts of this is I really see America in this guide. I mean, that's obvious. It's American films. Of course, we're going to see America. But I think something Dan brought up and Annette addressed is, are other countries responsible for their own history? Is this going to be something that maybe others get inspired by to do the same thing in their own countries? Because this is just so... I see America in these films, in this guide. This is, it's beautiful, it's wonderful, and do with it what you will, and use it, and add to it, and, you know, just use it, read it, love it. Give us more information. We want more information about it. If you see a film that rings a bell, gee, haven't I seen this in my university library? Go find out. Contact one of us. Add it to the list. I hope there will be another edition, but as Annette said, that's kind of tough. If any of you knows of funding, let us know, because we want to keep this going on, and we want to build it and grow it and make it more useful to everybody.
Do I state this correctly, that in addition to being a traditional book, the finished version will also be on the web, right? And so with something on the web that has embedded links that take you directly to the movie, this is going to be pretty incredible impact, I think. Thanks to Annette and Rick and everybody else. It's a fabulous project, and all of you are part of it. So let's give them a hand, but also help them out and make this thing grow. So we have a couple hours, and see you back here at 8 o'clock for some absolutely brilliant screenings that Rick's put together.